Hello, everyone, and welcome in to the Youth Hoops Pod presented by Pro Skills Basketball. Today, you are going to listen to a conversation that features both PSB co-founders Brendan Winters and Logan Kosmalski, and also ESPN analyst and former Duke basketball player Jay Billis. This conversation will cover youth sports parenting, the NCAA, toughness, and much more. You're only going to be listening to 30 minutes of the previously recorded webinar today. If you would like to listen to the full conversation, go to www.psbplus.com to start your 30-day free trial and check out the full conversation. We hope you enjoy, and we'll see you soon.
Welcome to another Pro Skills Basketball webinar. I'm PSB co-founder Logan Kosmalski. Very excited for tonight's conversation entitled Toughness, Youth Sports Parenting, the NCAA, and more. I'm going to hop right into it right now. I'm going to introduce our panelists. First is the other half of the PSB co-founding team, former Davidson College player, former European basketball professional player, and Pro Skills Basketball co-founder, Brendan Winters.
How you doing?
Our next panelist is very excited to have him here. Former Duke Blue Devil basketball player, current ESPN basketball analyst, Jay Billis. Jay, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm excited to be with you.
Let's hop right into it, Jay. Obviously, today is April 21st, 2020. We're in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. The world of sports, the whole world is sort of on lockdown right now. I would like you to give us your thoughts about where we are, particularly within the world of sports, particularly within the world of basketball, and kind of how you see this whole situation playing out over the next couple of months or weeks.
Yeah, that's a good question. I wish I had a definitive answer for what I believe may happen. I just don't know. And I think we're all in the same boat there, that I tend to gravitate to what Dr. Anthony Fauci said, that the virus is going to give us the timeline. We're not going to be able to create a timeline of our own about how we get back to whatever normal is going to be in the short run. But there's so many things that are at play here. One is, when does for parents and for administrators, when does school start again? Whether it's high school or college, basketball or any sport seems secondary to students being back on campus and that part of things starting up again. As far as what happens this summer, with if you're a high school player, looking to go to college, you would normally be playing, maybe going to a camp or playing with your high school team for a period of time, but also playing in the summer basketball circuit. That's going to depend on whether you have these organizers that are able to get their events up and running. And those are difficult things under normal circumstances, that if you had some sort of, like, say you had some weather catastrophe that knocked everything off, but you could still move forward in a normal society, that it'd be difficult to just start something up again under those circumstances. When you don't have normal society functioning, it throws a completely different dynamic into place, and I don't know how this is going to go. The only thing I do know is that the most important thing now is health and safety. And so whatever decisions are made, they have to be made with the health and safety of the participants first, and then those that'll be around the participants. And those are going to be decisions that are going to have to be made by experts that are beyond sort of my expertise and yours. And it's going to take a while for this to shake out, I think. And if we think we're going to get back to, sort of normal, some sort of normal existence by May, that seems ambitious right now. But Brent and I were talking about this earlier before we came online, that if you had told us in January, February that we would be in this position now, we wouldn't have believed it. So look how fast things move there. Hopefully it'll move faster than we expect in the other direction, but there's no evidence that it will.
Yeah. And Jay, a follow-up question to that is, you're a pretty frequent critic of the NCAA. particularly NCAA sports and in college basketball and football. Do you see this, the current situation, as somewhat of an opportunity that the NCAA can make some pretty broad sweeping changes? Or do you see the problems that you talk about consistently when it comes to the, you know, the compensation of players and the money involved in the NCAA? Does this situation kind of lend itself to an opportunity to fix those problems, or do you see those problems being exacerbated by the situation that we're in?
That's a great question. And, you know, I look at myself as being, I guess critic is certainly fair, of being, you know, covering NCAA policy in addition to covering an NCAA sport, which is college basketball for me. But when I get involved in policy discussion, sometimes I'm on the side of, hey, this is right. Sometimes I'm on the side of, hey, this needs to be changed, needs to be reformed, whatever. And so you kind of hold the light up to what is said and then what's done and see if they match up. I think this pandemic that we're going through, just as if we were going through an economic depression or, you know, something like that, that's the same level of catastrophe, you have an opportunity for it to hit the reset button. And right now, especially when you've got this much time to be able to take a step back and say, not only what do we need to do in response to this, but what should we do? What should this be like? So to give you an example of what I'm talking about, right now you're hearing a lot of college administrators say, hey man, if we don't play football, we got a world of hurt coming our way, because they've got to be able to hit their budget, and they have to have revenue in order to pay all their obligations, and including paying the school. You know, the school relies upon the athletic department to pay the school a certain amount of money. So the schools have all budgeted for the athletic department to be a revenue driver for itself or for the school. So the first response they have is, well, we'll cut sports. We may have to cut sports. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I don't believe you have to cut sports, just as you don't have to cut the English department or cut political science. You don't have to do any of that stuff. What you may have to do is reassess the amount you're spending, whether all these games that are being played are appropriate. You know, do all these schools need to be in the conferences they're in for every sport? Like, can you be in one conference for football and basketball and be in another conference for some of your other sports? Of course you can, but it's going to require a rethinking of things, and maybe a rethinking of the NCAA structure, and frankly, a rethinking of the leadership, that this is an opportunity to make leadership changes and shape things to the way you want it to be rather than the way it has been.
Do you think those conversations are taking place right now?
No, I think some are. There are conversations taking place with regard to the finances. What do we do if we don't have the money coming in, and how do we respond? And these are all really difficult issues. This is difficult for the restaurant industry, for the entertainment industry, of which college athletics is a part. This is the entertainment industry, even though there's an educational aspect to it. You know, they're talking about playing so they get people to come watch and pay, and so they can satisfy their media rights deals. That's entertainment, man. And it's all great. I'm not arguing with it. It's fantastic. But this is the entertainment business, and everybody's starting to realize that. Do I think they're having conversations about how do we get up and running again? What do we do? You know, they're gaming it out basically with different scenarios as to what if we can't play football and have people on campus. Like, how do you have a football season if you can't have students on campus during the summer? And get the teams prepared. And if you can't play right away, could we start playing in January and then play, have football go into May? Things like that. I know they're discussing all those things, and then contingency plans and then budget issues and all that. But are they talking about the structure itself and how can they govern differently? Do they need to make changes in leadership? I don't think they've gotten there yet. At least I haven't heard that.
Wow, that you just brought up a lot of things I hadn't thought about. I guess I'm kind of a one-track mind with basketball, so we'll keep it there. It seems like there's been quite a few interesting things happen over the last month in terms of NCAA basketball. I mean, you have the Scheme documentary come out, which was not a great look for the NCAA. You have the G League rolling out their, I guess, higher payments for the elite level high school kids, and you have two of the top kids taking that, at least so far. The transfer portal is crazy right now, and it sounds like, I don't know if they've ruled on it yet, but it sounds like they might waive the redshirt year, which you talk a lot about, and you're a fan of that anyway, but it's, I mean, the numbers of transfers is incredible. And then, like we talked about before, you have the possibility of no live periods for high school juniors, sophomores, juniors, seniors this year, which would really, really hurt their recruiting and in turn hurt college basketball. So, I mean, with all of those, I know I just mentioned four or five things, with all of those things happening right now within that directly impact college basketball, NCAA basketball, you know, what are your thoughts on kind of just the state of where NCAA basketball is right now?
Well, like a lot of other things, it's in a little bit of upheaval, and it seems that there's some instability. I don't know that it's necessarily unstable. It's just changing and evolving. So first on the sort of the transfer portal or transfer policy, one of the biggest issues with transfer policy has been it's not based on any principle. So you've got players that have to sit out. If they decide they want to transfer five or six sports, they have to sit out a year, which is called a year in residence. That's an old antiquated notion that came from when there was freshman ineligibility. The idea was, if you transfer, you need a redshirt year to acclimate yourself to your new school. Well, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense when a high school player can commit to a college and play right away. A high school player doesn't have to acclimate to college, but someone who has college experience and is going to another college needs to sit out. That doesn't make any sense. It's really a penalty and a deterrent for transfer. But it only applies to those six sports. So there are, you know, 26 other sports that you can transfer and play right away. So it's kind of hard to say, well, competitive balance is important. And then you'll have coaches that'll say, well, players have to have accountability. They're not mature enough to be able to make these decisions, things like that. You know, they play that accountability card all the time. And then a redshirt year is really good for a player. You know, they can sit out, they can get their academics in order, they can work on their bodies, get acclimated to the new system. It's really, really a great thing. When the truth is, most coaches want their transfers to be able to play right away. That's just sort of an excuse that's used. And to me, it seems kind of bizarre that we could say, well, a person that has been to college and has played for at least a year in college can't be trusted to make the decision to leave. You know, like coaches say, well, first sign of you know, adversity, they want to pack up and go. I don't think that's true. I think it's just something we conveniently say. But so we can have a high school kid with no college experience at all that has to make a binding decision coming out of high school. It should be bound by that decision. We can't trust the college player to make that decision on what's best for him or her. I just don't find that persuasive. So here's what I've proposed to a bunch of coaches over the years. Like, they think that I'm totally against the redshirt and sitting out a year. I'm not. I just think that if it's going to be implemented, it needs to be implemented based upon principle. So if we could show somehow, we being the college system, could show somehow that, you know, it's better for a player's academics, they're in better shape to graduate if they take that redshirt year. If there's data behind that, let's do it. You know, I've suggested, and nobody's listened, but I've suggested that if you transfer from, I don't know, Duke to Davidson, because that's where we all went. So if you transfer from Duke to Davidson, and Davidson will take all of your credits, and you're on track as soon as you step on campus, you should be able to play right away. Now, if you can't, then you should sit that year while you get your academics in order so that you're on track to graduate at your new school. That seems like it's a pretty good idea. And based on an academic principle. But the NCAA has already come out, one of their committees come out and said there's no data that shows that you're in better shape to graduate by sitting out a year when you transfer. And so I think they're gonna pass this in May. There and say you can have a one-time transfer exception and be able to play right away, kind of like grad transfer can. There are a lot of coaches that I like and respect that are totally against that, but think it's going to be this chaotic situation. We're going to have dogs and cats living together and the whole thing's going to collapse under its own weight. I don't agree with that. I think it'll be challenging for some coaches, but I don't think it'll be that big of a deal. I think we'll handle it just fine and adjust to it. And they also say there's going to be poaching. There's going to be players that are coaches that are going to recruit players off of another roster. And my thing has been, that's a coach's problem. Like if you can't control your own brethren, why should the players have to bear that burden of saying, because coaches may act inappropriately, all of you should sit out when you transfer. That to me makes no sense at all. And I'm talking a long time, but to your thing about the Jalen Green, Isaiah Todd, who are going to the G League with this new elite program that the G League is putting in, that's really good policy for the NBA. I think the NBA is doing the right thing for its business. It is going to negatively affect college. It will not kill college basketball. It will not diminish it to a level where it's like college baseball or anything. That's not going to happen. But it strains the mind to believe that we could eliminate the one and done rule and you could have all the best talent either go to the G League or go into the NBA and college basketball is going to be better. That's a pipe dream. And college basketball would not be better without Zion Williamson and without Cole Anthony and without, Kevin Durant, you name all those since 2006 that have played in college for just a year. It's been a long list of benefits to college rather than it detracting from it. And, you know, again, really good friends of mine that are coaches have said, hey, you know, this last year we had Obi Toppin and Luka Garza, we'll be just fine. Well, you had them anyway, and you had all these other players. That did not hurt college. And why we want to put up a stop sign and say, we don't need any of these really good players if they don't want to be here. But we never say anything about football. We never say, well, why are we making these football players stay for 3 years when they should have the same choice as a basketball player? The truth is all these sports will be just fine, but they're just policy decisions that each sport makes. The NFL, the NBA, they make policy decisions. And the NCAA makes their own. And right now our policy decision in college is we don't want Zion Williamson anymore because he makes us look bad. You know, he, a guy like him takes all this attention, then he leaves right away, and we can't tout education, and it looks like we're using him. And I don't think that's the way we should be looking at it. I think we should be welcoming young people to college. If they want to stay a year and leave, they're more likely to come back if they've been there. I don't think anybody benefits from people bypassing college. I think I'm not saying they shouldn't be allowed to do what they want to do. That's up to the NBA. But in response to it, the NCAA shouldn't just say, in my view, shouldn't just say, well, if you don't want to be Shane Battier, good riddance. You know, don't come into our area because, you know, we have our nose in the air and we're going to tout academics. We should be saying, no, we think it's the right thing for you to be here. And we want you in our system, and we will work with you, even if you want to go chase your pro dream, we'll work with you to get your education and further it if we really believe that's the best thing. And I do, and I think you guys do too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm interested to know. I thought the scheme, I mean, it was really interesting for me, the documentary just released on HBO dealing with, I guess paying players. So, just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Have you seen it? And if you have, what did you think about it?
I did see the scheme. I saw it a couple weeks actually before it aired. They sent it, they call it a screener. So they sent it to a bunch of different media folks to try to get buzz about the documentary before it came out. And it did get a lot of buzz before it came out. I enjoyed watching it like I do most of these things you see. I knew a good bit of it. I hadn't heard some of the wiretap recordings that were in it. Some of them I had read about, but I had heard them. So there was some new things in there. And I have honestly kind of mixed feelings about it. Like, I've known that there's been cheating going on in basketball for the last 70 years. I mean, I know that's happening. But when coaches get caught, you kind of think, okay, well, the system is going to respond. And that's where I was incorrect, frankly, when a few years ago, I don't even know the timeline now, but a few years ago when there was information reported about Arizona, I kind of thought, all right, this is, the university is going to act on this. And they haven't. So LSU, Arizona, some of these other places, they're basically saying, all right, well, you have to show me direct evidence. I need a body and a murder weapon before I'm going to believe that anything happened. And I that has floored me, that after you hear those tapes, now you can say, hey, it doesn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that somebody did this, that, or the other, but you can't tell me that nothing happened here. And you can't tell me that somehow that everybody's lying. You know, assistant coaches lied, not knowing they were on wiretap, and officers of the court lied in calling sitting head coaches as witnesses that they were trying to perpetrate a fraud on the court. I just don't believe any of that. So, you know, look, if somebody proves to me otherwise, I'll be the first to say, hey, you know, there was nothing there. But you can't tell me there's nothing there on this. And so I'm more like, I'm not down on the coaches. I knew that stuff was going on. What I'm down on is the administrators. Like, I want the administrator to quit saying integrity. Like, quit telling me that. I don't want to hear it anymore. If you're gonna keep some of these guys employed at your school, then you have no right to lecture me on integrity. I don't want to hear it. And I'm tired of all these places talking about, you know, well, we compliance and all that. Like, shut up. I've had enough of that, because they're not living what they're talking. You can't with a straight face tell me that nothing happened at these places. That's absurd.
And Jay, kind of a follow-up question to that is, like, part of my favorite time of the year is watching the coaching carousel in college basketball when the season is over and who's being talked about getting hired here. And over the last couple of years, it's become really apparent to me is, like, you see good coaches getting passed up for big names that have been places in the past and have been caught cheating or have had these issues happen within their programs, and they still continue to get jobs on the line. Can you speak a little bit to that and what you think is going on there, as far as, especially from the administrator perspective? If I'm an administrator at a big time school, why am I hiring somebody that has been run out of a previous program due to you know, rule infractions?
Yeah, Logan, it's because they want to win. That's all it boils down to is that the rewards of winning go beyond sort of this feeling of kind of compliance and integrity and all the stuff they talk about. And I get it. I mean, I'm not, there are some of these things that I don't think should be illegal anyway. So it's kind of an issue of, well, you know, are the rules fair, and what happened in a coach's past? But there are certain things that have been kind of third rail type issues, and paying players under the table has been one of them. You know, it's one thing if you know, like, just take with Bruce Pearl being hired at Auburn. You know, it's one thing if Auburn says, hey, look, Bruce Pearl had a barbecue at his house and had a recruit there that he shouldn't have had there, and then wasn't honest about it. I get it. Like, that was not a good thing, and he paid a high price. Bruce Pearl paid a really high price for that. Now, I think that's a little bit different in my view than hiring a person who's been through that, than hiring a person who's been caught paying players. That's a different deal to me. But look, reasonable minds can differ on all these things. All I know is, like, I'm a little bit I'm beyond a little bit. I'm extraordinarily disappointed in the presidents and athletic directors, not only of the individual schools we're talking about here, or that I'm talking about, not you guys, but I'm talking about, but the commissioners, presidents, and ADs of their fellow institutions within their leagues that aren't standing up and saying, you know what, we're not putting up with this. And I'm certainly not going to remain silent about it. They're not doing that. Now, you could argue, I realize that that's asking a lot. Like, it's asking a lot for somebody to stand up and point a finger at someone else and say, you know what, they're not doing it the right way, and we are not comfortable with that, and putting pressure on them that way. But given the rhetoric that's used within the NCAA structure, I don't see how that they can avoid it. You guys might have been there. I don't remember. I would go to so many of these things. But I was at a conference last year where a very prominent commissioner, who's a great person, stood up and said, I can't believe what coaches will tolerate among their ranks. And I was in the audience listening to it. I'm going, what coaches tolerate? I'm like, look who's in your league. Like, you know, you're kind of tolerating it too. And you've got authority. Like, why don't you stand up and say something? But so he felt comfortable enough to say, hey, you guys shouldn't tolerate it, and pointing to all the coaches, but didn't feel comfortable enough to stand up and say, but I'm not going to tolerate it in my league. And again, I'm asking a lot there. That's a big ask to have somebody come out and you know, sort of point a finger at another institution, another administrator. Those are difficult things. But when we tout in college athletics how important integrity is and the like, and how important compliance is, it just seems to me that that shouldn't be as hard in this industry as it seems to be.
So, Jay, I always think about the story of Coach K in his first couple of years at Duke. He was a relatively unknown hire, and he was given a couple of years to build a program. You don't really see that a whole lot anymore. Do you think that those days of hiring lesser known coaches to big programs and giving them time to you know, essentially lose for a few years and build up a winning program that has a strong foundation, do you think that those days are over?
That's a great question. I don't think they're over. I just think it's more difficult now because of the amount of money that's involved. I don't remember how much he was making, because I was there. My first year at Duke was his third year there. But I don't think he was even making $50,000 when he first got hired at Duke a year. And now, you know, coaches are making, like, your video coordinator makes more than that. And it's not just inflation. I mean, there's just more money in the system. So you could argue there's more of a premium on winning, more goes with winning now. So, but still, there's more job security in college sports than there is anywhere else in sports. Coaches, absent just horrible losing, coaches have pretty good job security, and they make incredibly good money. And so many of them do. I mean, there are 350 Division I institutions just in basketball alone. So there's a lot of money flowing through the system, but there's no question that money is a big factor. And especially when we're talking about these major, you know, sort of Power Five institutions, the top ones, they realize the difference between being average and being really good and championship caliber, the difference in money. And I can tell you that I don't think anybody, you know, I need to even hedge on this. You know, when LSU was going through all that stuff with Will Wade and they suspended him, when the initial reports came out, you know, they had one of the best teams in the country. They won the SEC. They had a legitimate chance to reach a Final Four that year. And their fans were up in arms over his suspension. And their fan base was basically, wait a minute, we're really good now. Let's not do this. Let's do it after the season. We can vacate all the games if it's all true, but don't do it now. And they were pointing at other teams in their league, like, they've been cheating forever. And now we get good, and all of a sudden we gotta, you know, suspend our coach. that was part of the problem, if you want to call it a problem, at LSU, is that, you know, the athletic director tried to make a move on Will Wade, and they fired the athletic director. And so it's just those things that are so difficult now. to your question about Coach K, you know, they fired coaches back then too, but there just wasn't as much at stake and there wasn't as big of a price to pay for making a change. Now you make a change and it's a multi-million dollar issue.
Hey, I want to do a bit of a 180 here. We've been focusing a little bit on kind of issues or problems, you know, within college basketball, but I'd like to turn it around and focus on what I think is one of the best youth basketball opportunities in the U.S., which is your summer camp, Jay Billis Skills Camp, that I've been lucky enough to have been a part of the last few years. Unfortunately, you guys made the decision to you were forced to cancel it. It was supposed to be at the beginning of June. Can you talk about the camp a little bit for those people out there who don't know much about it, what it's all about, how long we've been doing it, and I guess, you know, talk a little bit about your decision to cancel it as well.
Yeah, Brendan, I started this camp along with a friend of all of ours named John Searby. And John was a played in college and was a college athletic director, college coach, a Division I assistant, and just a great guy with a fantastic perspective on things. And when my son was coming up through kind of the high school summer circuit, my wife had asked me, hey, you need to coach his basketball team. She didn't like kind of the way that the players were being treated in the AU program that he was in. So she said, you need to step in here. And so I did, and I coached with John. That was really the getting to know him. And you know, you guys have dealt with this forever. But for me, you know, going through the AAU experience, I had always gone to summer basketball games, and I'd watched the very best players. So I kind of had this, you know, sort of sitting up in first class view of things. And I wasn't in all the side gyms. And so when my boy was playing, I was in the side gyms, and I had said to John one time, I go, is it all like this? And he said, yeah, it is. And I didn't care for him. And so, you know, there were certain aspects of it that were great, but certain aspects of it that really bothered me. And so John had a really big impact on me in that. And, you know, we had talked a lot about it, and he says, look, we can't fix all this, but he said, we can make an impact in our backyard. And meaning Charlotte, North Carolina, where we both live and where you guys live. And so we came up with the concept for the camp that we wanted to make it kind of an old school skills camp where we could bring players in. We wanted to bring only kind of Division One, former Division One or Division Two and Division Three head coaches. And then people we knew that were legit. And so we brought in what we consider to be a great staff. And then we also had the idea of this coaches development program where we bring in younger coaches that could help staff the camp, but they would work on the staff of a head coach. And we got them classroom training, USA basketball certification, speakers brought in, all this stuff where they were busy all the time. But, you know, we couldn't believe, okay, look at all the eyeballs we have on the players. We're, you know, we felt like we're teaching the players and then in a way kind of coaching the coaches. And so it's been a rewarding experience for us. It's been wonderful for me because I've learned a ton. We hope it's been good for the players, but we spend an inordinate amount of time. You guys have been such, you know, influential parts of it, of, you know, trying to get the players what they need, but also to help them realize, like, look, this goes beyond basketball. So here's how you take care of the facility. Here's how you take care of your room. When you go on the road, here's how you take care of your hotel room. And you know, you sit with somebody different each day. And you guys need to be empathetic about, you know, what other players are going through in this whole thing. And, you know, we've had players that were really good and have gone on. We've had players gone on playing the NBA. Then we've had players that their first couple of days of camp, they weren't sure they even belonged there. And we were able to get help them to, here's where you can really make an impact and where you can fit in, where you can have an impact on your team and maybe the opportunity to go back and make your team in high school and all that stuff. So it's been a wide ranging thing. And as to the cancellation of this year, It was in one regard, it was really a difficult decision, but then another way it was easy because we've always been bringing players in from all over the country and people from all over the country. And it just didn't make any sense for us when there was so much uncertainty as to what was going to be happening in June to say, okay, we're willing to bring in people from all these different pockets of the country, congregate together, and then we're going to send them back out. That didn't seem to be responsible to me. And so we felt the responsible thing was let's shuttle this now, and we'll be fully prepared next year to get back to business and be prepared. But we just didn't want people on the hook for this and have even further uncertainty as we get into June. It was difficult, but not difficult when we're faced with what we're all faced with.